This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of audio reading service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Mary with my partner,
Rachel.
For the next 2 hours, we'll be reading selections from the November 22nd, 2025 weekend edition of the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Copyright 2025. We'll begin with the news for the first 40 minutes. After the news, we'll read area death notices until complete and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read the number of features from the living section, including horoscopes and advice columns. After that, we'll read perspectives, including editorials and letters to the editor. After the editorials, we'll read TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. And now, the headlines from the front page of the November 22nd weekend edition of the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette are: Tough Times for Food Banks. Trump friendly with new New York mayor. Judge blistering opinion details use of force in Chicago. And Supreme Court ICE's order blocking Texas maps. And now here is Rachel with the first local article.
Tough times for food banks. Need increases in time of inflation, reduced federal help. Byline Desiree Clausen, Fort Wayne Media Collaborative. Officials with the Neighborhood Food Network, operated by Associated Churches of Fort Wayne and Allen County, are facing some tough decisions as the holidays approach. We've been able to survive this year because we've done some additional food drives, which have enabled us to keep up with the need, said Gary Pook, Director of Finance for the organization. But if things continue as they are now, we may have to look at using emergency funds before the end of the year. The Neighborhood Food Network is a collection of 21 food pantries across Fort Wayne and Allen County. Like thousands of other food banks nationwide, the network has experienced year-over-year increases in need since the COVID-19 pandemic, Pook said. He added that the issue has been exacerbated by inflation, restrictions of government benefits, and, most recently, the ongoing government shutdown that has delayed benefits through the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, or food stamps. Pook said the first stark increase in patrons this year followed U.S. House Resolution 1, the nearly 1,000-page-long One Big Beautiful Bill Act, supported by President Donald Trump. The bill was signed into law on July 4th and, among other impacts, cut $186 billion in SNAP benefits through 2034. As a result of that, we found that the people here in Fort Wayne and Allen County that we deal with on a regular basis either had their benefits cut completely or, more often than not, had them reduced, he said. Less funding. The Neighborhood Food Network tries, wherever possible, to pick up that slack, Pook said. However, he added, recent reductions in federal funding means filling those gaps is harder than ever. Other federal budget cuts this year cost Associated Churches about $45,000 in funding that normally would be used to buy food for their pantries. That money, Pook said, would have come from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Specifically, the FEMA, cuts included funds set aside for emergency food and the agency's Emergency Food and Shelter Program. Funding for the latter program was suspended indefinitely in January, he said. Comparing the first 9 months of last year to the first 9 months of this year, and overall our income from in-kind or from actual cash donations is down by about 28%, and our spending is only down about 7%, so we go farther in the hole every month, Pook said. The need surged again in response to the government shutdown's threat to SNAP benefits. Indiana's Family and Social Services Administration announced on November 4th that the maximum allotment for SNAP benefits would be reduced by 35%. SNAP benefits are determined by subtracting 30% of a household's income from the maximum allotment, meaning this change will reduce benefits for every SNAP recipient. The shutdown ended November 12th, and the FSSA resumed giving full SNAP benefits November 15th, according to the Indiana agency. Before the deduction, the maximum allotment started at $298 for a one-person family, increasing by around $230 with each additional family member. The maximum net monthly income starts at $1,305 and increases by roughly $450 for each additional family member. The administration also announced that benefits will be delayed by at least a week. On its first distribution day following the state's announcement, St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, one of Associated Church's pantries, supported 17 families in 2.5 hours, a sharp increase from its usual 10 to 12 families per day, said Sue Bernard, a representative from the food bank. 8 of them were new families to us, Bernard said. We knew this was coming, but it was a noticeable difference. More need. Community harvest food banks are feeling a similar strain. In 2020, the organization was shaken when the number of families seeking help reached 1,500 on some distribution days, Insights Director Logan Hafner said. This year, it's rare to see less than 1,800 families on a Saturday, an increase he described as startling. On November 8th, Community Harvest distributed food to 1,958 families, Hafner said. This has been their highest distribution day this year, but was in line with what they expected, considering the overall increase in volume before the shutdown. He said they expect to see a prolonged increase in visitors, even after the reinstatement of benefits, as their patrons were struggling to an unprecedented degree prior to the shutdown. Everyone talks about how crazy it got during COVID, but right now it is a higher level of service than was provided during COVID, except we don't have all the additional government support because it's no longer a state of emergency, Hafner said. I think it grew slowly enough and was sustained enough that people just kind of got used to it and accepted it as a new reality, but it is more dire now than it was then. September 30th marked the end of the first quarter of Community Harvest's fiscal year, and the nonprofit had seen a 12.8% increase in distribution when compared to the first quarter of 2024, Hafner said. From 2023 to 2024, the food bank noticed a 20% increase in distribution, with only a 1.2% increase in food brought in. That meant the organization spent 12% more of its funds on food to meet the demand. That's not sustainable because we can't afford to buy all of the food that will be required to increase inventory to be able to serve the number of people we did last year, Hafner said. And we also expect that number to continue to grow, which it has in all but one of our in-house programs. One area that has seen the largest dip in donations is from retail surplus. During COVID, many stores decreased their waste buffer in response to a decrease in sales, meaning less excess to be donated. The Zero Waste Initiative stayed in place even when sales bounced back, Hafner said, permanently reducing donations. We are talking constantly about food sourcing efforts, and one of the things we have all agreed on that needs to be a focus this year is finding new donors, he said. Usually our conversations can stem around, how do we talk to our best donors to try and get more from them? This year, it's inescapable. We have to find new donors. We're doing all sorts of things to increase our efficiency, to make less food go further. Other ways. To supplement food bank efforts, Forward Indiana, a mutual aid organization, has placed a renewed effort on its community pantries. These food pantries are freestanding and unmanned, available for anyone to drop off or pick up food at any time. The organization has founded 31 of these pantries in total, with 17 spread across Fort Wayne. Forward Indiana views them as the community's property, a sentiment reflected in its patrons, said Curtis Liberalis, a representative from the organization. It's honestly almost overwhelming just how many people are willing to put in so much effort into making sure our neighbors are fed, Liberalis said. Just the way these pantries have thrived for the last several years, and the way our community members have come to really own them as, "This is my pantry." The pantries function differently from traditional food banks because they have little to no barriers to access and function on a much lower budget as they're entirely community run. Although this means the supply of food can be inconsistent, the pantries can help make up the difference as more pressure is put on food banks, Liberalis said. Even once the government reopens, which hopefully it will, it doesn't mean that the need will immediately go away, he said. People will have spent their reserves trying to get through, and our neighbors are going to rely on these pantries for the foreseeable future. Hafner said there's been an increased focus on data from foundations and organizations that donate to nonprofits, which has been a struggle for food banks that focus on having low barriers. Visiting a food bank is already a vulnerable experience, and adding surveys and questionnaires have the potential to make seeking assistance even more stressful, he said. Community Harvest has been working on data collection over the last 2 years in anticipation of this change, but many local food banks haven't, which has left them floundering, Hafner said. In response, nonprofits have focused on collaboration and sharing methodologies to increase everyone's chances of receiving funds. Despite struggles with funding and increases in need, Hafner and Pook said their organizations are dedicated to supporting the community and are confident in their ability to make it through this hard time. We are preparing in a way that we have always prepared, Hafner said. We've been through COVID, we've been through national disasters. This is what we do. We always find a way to do it. We luckily have seen this community come together a number of times, and I have all the faith in the world that if that sort of need does arrive, the community will rise to the occasion, and we are ready to step up and serve.
Judge's blistering opinion details use of force in Chicago. This is from the Associated Press. Chicago. A judge's blistering 223-page opinion has offered a cache of striking new details from body camera footage about agents' use of force during a federal immigration crackdown in the Chicago area, dubbed Operation Midway Blitz. U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis' opinion issued Thursday recounts many high-profile clashes between federal agents and protesters, repeatedly using body camera footage to refute the federal government's narratives from court. Use of force reports filmed depositions and press releases. It describes scenes of agents launching tear gas without warning, aiming rubber rounds at reporters, tackling protesters, and laughing as blood oozed from a demonstrator's ear. Incidents, Ellis said, were flatly at odds with the government's own narratives. Ellis expressed surprise about federal officials appointing her to specific videos, which she later found showed agents violating her orders restricting the use of force. The opinion outlines Ellis's findings in issuing preliminary injunction earlier this month in response to a lawsuit filed by news outlets and protesters who claim federal officers used excessive force during an immigration crackdown that has netted more than 3,000 arrests since September across the nation's third largest city and its many suburbs. Among other things, Ellis's order restricted agents from using physical force and chemical agents like tear gas and pepper balls unless necessary or to prevent an immediate threat. She said the current practices violated the constitutional rights of journalists and protesters. A federal appeals court on Wednesday temporarily halted the order, calling it overboard and too prescriptive. But the Seventh U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals also cautioned against overreading its stay and said a quick appeal process could lead to a more tailored and appropriate order. Tricia McLaughlin, a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, called the Seventh Circuit's ruling a win for the rule of law and for the safety of every law enforcement officer. Judge Ellis' thoughts on 20th century poetry and Chief Bovino's conduct in the order are noted, McLaughlin said in a statement to the Associated Press. They don't change the reality of the situation on the ground and at the appeals level. The opinion delineates the results of Ellis's review of extensive body-worn camera footage and testimony that she said reflected indiscriminate and disproportionate use of force as agents repeatedly used tear gas, rubber bullets, pepper balls, and flashbangs without warning or justification. It also described tense moments when Ellis said agents shot flashbang grenades at the backs of protesters as they fled, kicked protesters on the ground, caused a car accident during a Halloween celebration, threatened to shoot residents while pointing guns at them, shot pepper balls at the heads of journalists and praying clergy members, and tackled protesters to the ground. The opinion accuses federal agents of not following Ellis's previous orders by using tear gas and other weapons on peaceful protesters, failing to give two explicit warnings before deploying munitions, and not wearing clear identification. It also described agents' apparent delight as they lobbed tear gas canisters at protesters. One agent declared that we definitely gassed them when we leave. Just start throwing. And the expletive deleted. And another said, we can, expletive deleted, we can M up, according to body camera footage described in the opinion. Ellis also accused agents of actively attempting to rile up the protesters, making dismissive remarks and laughing while firing munitions at protesters. She described agents who laughed and made jokes about tear gassing protesters and were pushing people to the ground, then laughing about it, even as blood oozed from the ears of someone they pushed. In another instance, she described an agent saying, "No one can hear you," after tackling and arresting a reporter as he yelled that he was a journalist and sought out his colleague. The judge also accused Greg Bovino, the senior U.S. Border Patrol official leading the immigration crackdown in the Chicago area, of being evasive and outright lying during his testimony, including by lying about being hit in the head with a rock during a protest in the predominantly Mexican-American Chicago neighborhood of Little Village. Bovino repeatedly went back and forth between claiming he was hit with a rock before or after he fired tear gas at the crowd, according to the opinion. In one instance after another, Ellis used footage to dispute claims by agents, including that Bovino saw Latin King members, gang members, take weapons out of their car in Little Village, and that a protester threw a bicycle at an agent. Body-worn camera footage also revealed that an agent used the AI tool ChatGPT to write a narrative for a report based off just a brief sentence about an encounter and several images, according to the opinion. Taken together, Ellis said the documentation showed the federal government narrative was simply not credible, saying her review of the body camera footage supported plaintiff's allegations of undermining all of the defendant's claims. Steeped in pride for Chicago, the judge's opinion painted an image of Chicago far different from the portrayal of federal attorneys who characterized it as a place ransacked by rioters. Instead, Ellis proudly described neighbors showing up for one another by standing on the sidewalk to document law enforcement activities and protest against immigration enforcement activities they believe to be unjust, or simply praying the rosary to provide comfort and bear witness to those detained at the Broadview Detention Facility who are facing fear and uncertainty. This description of rapid response network members, neighbors, moms, and dads, Chicago Bears fans, people dressed in Halloween costumes, and the lawyer who lives on the block as professional agitators undermines the agent's credibility, she wrote.
Supreme Court ICE's order blocking Texas map, Associated Press. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday temporarily blocked a lower court ruling that found Texas's 2026 congressional redistricting plan, pushed by President Donald Trump, likely discriminates on the basis of race. The order, signed by Justice Samuel Alito, will remain in place at least for the next few days while the court considers whether to allow the new map, favorable to Republicans, to be used in the midterm elections. The court's conservative majority has blocked similar lower court rulings because they have come too close to elections. The order came about an hour after the state called on the high court to intervene to avoid confusion as congressional primary elections approach in March. The justices have blocked past lower court rulings in congressional redistricting cases, most recently in Alabama and Louisiana, that came several months before elections. The order was signed by Alito because he is the justice who handles emergency appeals from Texas. Texas redrew its congressional map in the summer as part of Trump's efforts to preserve a slim Republican majority in the House.
Trump friendly with new New York mayor. Former adversaries focus on city goals. This is by Michelle L. Price, The Associated Press. Washington. President Donald Trump on Friday met with the man who had proudly proclaimed himself Donald Trump's worst nightmare, but he seemed to find the opposite. The Republican president and the New York City mayor-elect, Zohran Mamdani, were warm and friendly, speaking repeatedly of their shared goals to help Trump's hometown rather than their combustible differences. Trump, who had in the past called Mondani a 100% communist lunatic and a complete nut job, spoke openly on how impressed he was with the man who had called his administration authoritarian. I think he is going to surprise some conservative people. Actually, Trump said of the Democratic Socialist as Mondani stood next to him in the Oval Office. The meeting offered political opportunities for both men. For Mondani, a sit-down offered the state lawmaker, who until recently was relatively unknown, the chance to go head-to-head with the most powerful person in the world. For Trump, it was a high-profile chance to talk about affordability at a time when he's under increasing political pressure to show he's addressing voter concerns about the cost of living. Until now, the men had been political foils who'd galvanized their supporters by taking on each other. And it's unclear how these backers will react to their genial get-together and complimentary words. We're going to be helping him to make everybody's dream come true, having a strong and very safe New York, the president said. What I really appreciate about the president is that the meeting that we focus not on places of disagreement, which there are many, and also focused on the shared purpose that we have in serving New Yorkers, Mondani said. Mondani and Trump said they discussed housing affordability and the cost of groceries and utilities as Mondani successfully used frustration over inflation to get elected, just as the president did in the 2024 election. Some of his ideas are really the same ideas that I have, the president said of Mondani about inflationary issues. The president brushed aside Mondani's criticism of him over his administration's deportation raids and claims that Trump was behaving like a despot. Instead, Trump said the responsibility of holding an executive position in the government causes a person to change, saying that had been the case for him. He seemed at times even protective of Mondani, jumping in on his behalf at several points. For example, when reporters asked Mondani to clarify his past statements, indicating he thought the president was acting like a fascist, Trump said, "I've been called much worse than a despot." Mondani, who takes office in January, said he sought the meeting with Trump to talk about ways to make New York City more affordable. Trump has said he may want to help him out.
Christmas with a Bang, Fireworks Mark Early Celebration Along Broadway by Tony Sandelman. Caitlin Heyman said she normally does not like to celebrate Christmas before Thanksgiving, but for her first Christmas on Broadway, she put that aside. "It's still fun. I'm not going to be a Grinch at this moment," she said. "After the fireworks, who's to say?" Heyman was one of thousands who attended Christmas on Broadway on Friday, the symbolic start to the holiday season in Fort Wayne, organizer Steve Shine said. Each year, the event is held outside the offices of the Shine and Hardin Law Firm off Broadway. It's been a 21-year tradition that has grown from about 150 people viewing the lighting in 2004 to nearly 5,000 people last year, Shine said. "I think the aura of an old-fashioned Christmas, with families gathered around a tree that gives the homespun feeling, that Christmas on Broadway radiates each year. The night included eggnog and cookies, an engine-powered train kids could ride, a parade featuring Santa Claus and a countdown to the lighting of a 40-foot-tall tree with 50,000 lights and fireworks. Shine said the tree plays a starring role on Broadway every year. After the countdown, the tree was illuminated and fireworks were launched as Andy Williams' song, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, played on loudspeakers. Heyman's husband, Logan, also a first-time attendee, said he had no issue celebrating Christmas before Thanksgiving. I'm 100% in with getting into Christmas as soon as possible, Logan said. I love Christmas. I want to put the tree up. The wife won't let me yet. That's okay. We'll get it up on Black Friday. Heyman was at Christmas on Broadway with his wife's parents and sister, who is celebrating her birthday. His mother-in-law, Brenda Robinson, said Christmas on Broadway should be compared to nationally known holiday celebrations. This is going to become bigger than Groundhog Day in Pennsylvania, she said. Punxsutawney Phil is nothing compared to this. Robinson's daughter carried around a sign that said, My birthday wish came true. Robinson said the birthday wish was to remain anonymous. So her family spoke to help make that wish come true. Joe Kerwin, another fan of celebrating Christmas early, has brought his children, ages 7 and 9, to Christmas on Broadway each of the last 5 years. He said their excitement brings them back each year. They just like fireworks and Christmas lights and Santa, he said, as they ran around his legs with cookies and candy canes. Christmas is really about the birth of Jesus, but this is a big community thing, and Christianity is about community. It's great for the kids. It's great for the adults, too. There's just a lot to do. Shine said his biggest motivation for putting the event on each year is seeing the excitement on children's faces. That is what this is all about, he said. It's about having a presentation that is heartwarming for families, making children happy, making parents enjoy watching their children see the awe of the lights on the tree being lit and the fireworks being displayed. This is truly a family-oriented event, and there were probably more kids here tonight than I've seen in the history of our event.
Braun on threats. Enough is enough. Says police on case. Zay Rogers share stories. This is by Nikki Kelly, Casey Smith, and Leslie Bonilla Menez from the Indiana Capital Chronicle. Governor Mike Braun on Friday condemned a wave of threats against state lawmakers, including ones he said targeted him and his family, shortly after Republican Senator Andy Zay confirmed a bomb threat at his Huntington vehicle rental business. Senator Linda Rogers revealed on Friday that she's also been a victim of several intimidation incidents. The threat came amid a week of swatting attempts and other harassment aimed at Senate Republicans. Enough is enough, the governor said in a Friday afternoon post on X. These threats to lawmakers, including those received by me and my family in recent days, need to stop. Braun said Indiana State Police and other law enforcement agencies have been working around the clock all week to protect lawmakers and investigate the string of incidents. The governor's office said state police are investigating more than one credible threat made against the governor, but did not provide details about the nature of those threats. Rest assured, if you threaten or attempt to carry out acts of violence against Indiana's elected officials, we will bring you to justice, Braun wrote. Hours before Braun's announcement, Zay shared his experience. Yesterday, my business in Huntington was targeted with a bomb threat, which is part of the recent troubling pattern against lawmakers in Indiana, Zay said. It's unfortunate that my family and I continue to be threatened for my work as a public servant and state senator, he added. This is no way to weigh in on any public issue, even if you do not agree with my stance. My office is always open, and I encourage constituents with any concerns to come reach out. Zay is supportive of a controversial proposal to redistrict Indiana's congressional boundaries and make Indiana's two blue districts red instead of the 2026 midterm elections. Sometimes you're not yes enough for some of our friends on the right, and when you get this mob mentality going, you know it's a little challenging, Zay told the Capital Chronicle. He said he has been quietly working behind the scenes with the Trump administration to move redistricting forward. Zay pushed for an aggressive marketing campaign to explain why the new map is needed to the public. He said the pressure and influence needed to come more from constituents. Obviously, the administration has chosen an entirely different tactic, which I don't agree with, which has kind of turned into this ugly, threatening, demeaning, bashing thing. I'm not surprised. It's certainly not uncharacteristic of the administration. But I think we all would have been better served to have a stronger groundswell of support to bring it to a vote. Zay said he is hopeful that vote can still happen. Another Republican senator, Linda Rogers of Granger, said Friday she's also been targeted. Rogers has not said publicly where she stands on redistricting. I can confirm I have been the victim of several intimidation incidents, but the St. Joseph County Police Department and the Indiana State Police are working diligently to get to the bottom of it, Rogers said in a statement. She commended both agencies for their timely response and assistance, but said she would not provide further details while the investigation continues. Earlier, fellow Republican Senator Kyle Walker of Lawrence said Thursday that attempts have been made to intimidate me and threaten violence on my home. A spokesperson clarified Friday that it was a bomb threat. Walker is against early redistricting. Four other GOP senators, all of whom oppose redistricting or are undecided, have been targeted in attempted swattings this week. Swatting involves hoax calls or reports to emergency services intended to trigger armed responses and can have lethal consequences for unwitting victims as the swatted location. The spate of harassment prompted bipartisan condemnation from leaders in the Indiana House. House Speaker Todd Houston and House Minority Leader Phil Giaquinta denounced the threats in a joint Friday statement. The threats, swatting attempts, and other criminal activity being directed at our colleagues in the Senate are abhorrent and completely unacceptable. This is no way to express political disagreement, and it must stop, the duo said. We thank our local, state, and federal law enforcement for responding to and investigating these crimes and for keeping our elected officials and their families safe. They continued, this is incredibly harmful to those being directly impacted and to our entire state. We're praying for our colleagues and their families and neighbors and our law enforcement partners. We hope to see swift justice for anyone responsible for these crimes. Zay also thanked police and said he's hopeful that state and local law enforcement will be able to find those responsible and hold them accountable for their actions.
And here are some area briefs, beginning with flags to be lowered for fallen deputy. Governor Mike Braun has directed flags to be flown at half staff in honor of a Delaware County deputy who died in the line of duty last week. Flags should be lowered from sunrise to sunset today, the day of Corporal Blake Reynolds' funeral. The order applies to flags at the State House, the Police and Firefighters Memorial, and all state facilities in Delaware County. Hoosiers are also encouraged to lower flags at homes and businesses statewide. City offices to close for holiday. The City of Fort Wayne's offices will be closed Thursday and Friday in recognition of the Thanksgiving holiday. Residential garbage and recycling will be delayed one day. Thursday's collection will happen on Friday, and Friday's collection will be pushed to Saturday. There will be no leaf collection on these weekdays. Traffic patterns to change on I-469. The Interstate 469 construction zone is set to change, the Indiana Department of Transportation announced on Friday. Construction crews plan today to switch southbound traffic back to the southbound side of I-469 from Stellhorn Road to US 24. Removal of the barrier wall on the northbound side of the interstate is expected to happen next week. The southbound I-469 exit ramp to eastbound US 24 is expected to reopen no sooner than December 1st. Once the ramp to eastbound US 24 reopens, traffic using the southbound exit ramp from I-469 to Rose Avenue will no longer be allowed to turn left to eastbound US 24. All work is weather dependent and schedules are subject to change.
Coroner IDs driver who died after house crash. This is from the Journal Gazette. A 23-year-old man was identified Friday as the driver who died after crashing into a house, the Allen County Coroner's Office said. Cameron Dylan Parker of Fort Wayne died of multiple blunt force injuries, and his death was ruled accidental. His death marks the 38th traffic fatality this year in Allen County. Parker was fleeing from police and not wearing a seatbelt when the crash in the 5700 block of Roaring Fork Run happened, a news release said. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Officers were chasing the driver, who was speeding on North Clinton Street. He turned on St. Joe Center Road before driving into the Paper Mill Bluffs neighborhood. Parker's vehicle left the street, striking two parked vehicles before crashing into a house. No one else was injured. The crash remains under investigation by the Fort Wayne Police Department and the coroner.
Survey: Thanksgiving costs rise. Byline: Tom Davies, Indiana Capital Chronicle. An annual survey shows that the traditional Thanksgiving meal will be a tick more expensive for Hoosier families this year. Indiana Farm Bureau's annual market-based survey found the cost of a 10-person Thanksgiving dinner averages $53.62, up 6% from 2024. That compares to a national average price this year of $55.18. The expected cost of $21.09 for a 16-pound turkey is virtually the same as last year, with produce prices the driver of the slight overall increase, according to Indiana Farm Bureau Chief Economist Todd Davis. Those higher prices are seen in carrots and celery for a veggie tray, which saw a 43-cent increase, sweet potatoes, 30-cent increase, pumpkin pie filling, which had a 24-cent increase, and peas with a 14-cent increase. Fresh produce markets can be very volatile, and many of these items saw an increase in wholesale and retail prices nationally, Davis said. Those retail prices reflect an increase in factors beyond the farm gate, including transportation, labor, fuel, packaging, and more that contribute to the overall increased cost of the product. The survey's price calculation includes the 16-pound turkey, stuffing, sweet potatoes, rolls, peas, a carrot and celery veggie tray, whole milk, cranberries, whipping cream, ingredients for pumpkin pie, and miscellaneous baking items. The Farm Bureau says its market survey was conducted in early November by volunteer shoppers across Indiana who search for the best prices at their local grocery stores while not using coupons or special promotions. With the turkey making up 39% of the total dinner cost, the Farm Bureau points to Indiana ranking fourth in national turkey production as helping the state's turkey price being about 2% less than the national average. Still, a Thanksgiving meal in Indiana costs about 25% more than it did in 2019, reflecting a trend of post-COVID-19 pandemic inflation that is still affecting grocery prices. The Thanksgiving meal survey found a cost of $42.66 in 2019, but it has fallen about 12% since hitting a peak of $61 in 2022.